Good evening. I would like to say a few words to you on the subject of communication. Now, at this very moment, I'm using one of the most popular and useful forms of communication, radio. Through this method, I can instantly transmit my thoughts to all, wherever you may be. And you may be anywhere. And for those of you who are not, this broadcast will be repeated later. Now, it is essential that we all know what's going on, and indeed what isn't going on that should be. We must communicate with each other, and also with anyone else who we happen to meet, as clearly and concisely as possible, bearing in mind that what can't speak can't lie. You see, we all have something to say. What I mean to say is that if we all stand up and say what we mean, and at the same time be prepared to sit down and listen to what everyone else is saying, and then turn round and give an honest reply, we shall be stepping forward all together, and standing up and turning round and sitting down all over the world as one man. And what a sight that would be. Especially if the women joined in. So let us resolve here and now to try to make the other fellow, even if he happens to be a woman, because obviously women are, in a sense, lumped together. Make them understand us. All of us. And that includes you. And not forgetting, of course, everybody else. Good night.
We present Lines from My Grandfather's Forehead, a sequential entertainment for radio, starring Ronnie Barker, also featuring Terence Brady and Pauline Yates, with Gordon Langford at the piano.
Good morning, Mrs. Brady.
Mr. Brady, Doctor.
Look, I haven't got time to split hairs, Mrs. Brady. Now then, what seems to be the trouble?
It's my throat, Doctor.
I see. And what exactly do you think is wrong with your so-called throat, may I ask?
Well, I'd say it was tonsillitis. You know, inflammation of the membranous tissue surrounding the tonsil. High fever, headache, all the usual symptoms. Oh, I get it regularly.
Tonsillitis, eh? Oh, dear me. Would you mind taking your trousers off?
Yes.
I want to examine your feet. Come on. Tonsillitis, indeed. Oh, dear me. Now then, show me your right foot.
Well, that's it. Opposite my left one.
Now, let me see. That's the one on my left and on your right.
That's the one, Doctor.
Oh, good. Good. So far, so good. Now, come on. Take off your sock. Oh, dear me. Oh, dearie, dearie. I thought as much.
Serious?
I'm afraid there's a chance you'll never play football again.
I don't play football. I don't even like the game.
Well, I would in that case say quite categorically that you will never play football again. Now, let's have a look at the old throat, shall we?
Why, could the two things be connected?
No. Your throat's not connected to your toes. Otherwise, every time you spoke, you'd trip yourself up. This is no laughing matter. Now, I'm sorry, but you were wrong. It is tonsillitis. Inflammation of the membranous tissue surrounding the tonsil. Nothing to do with your feet at all.
Oh, I'm sorry, Doctor. I didn't mean to mislead you.
You'd better pop into hospital and have the old appendix out, I think, just to be on the safe side. Oh, that reminds me, I'll give you something for those feet of yours.
What?
Shoes and socks, I think. They're usually the best. We can't have you wandering about like that, can we? Naked feet?
And the tonsils?
Oh, no, we wouldn't suit the tonsils. No good for tonsils at all. Come back and see me in about a year when you've had a few rounds of golf.
Yes, Doctor, yes. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Goodbye. Oh, Mrs. Brady, don't forget your trousers. Can't have you wandering about like that. Surest way of catching tonsillitis.
One out.
Looks like it, doesn't it?
You yellow fevers are all the same. Toffee nosed lot.
As it happens, I'm not. Toffee nosed or yellow fever.
What sort of germ are you then? I'm bubonic, of course.
Yes. Really?
No, I'm not. No, I'm not even influenza.
Oh, never mind. Looks aren't everything, you know.
I'm just...
Yes?
I'm just common cold.
Really? So am I.
Really? So am I. Oh, no, I've said that, haven't I? Well?
Well? What are we waiting for? Let's join the party.
Why not? Two head colds are better than one.
Doesn't know I've got a mistress.
My mistress doesn't know I've got a wife.
My husband doesn't know I've got a lover.
I love my wife more than my mistress.
I love my wife more than my mistress.
I don't love either of them much.
My wife has never met my mistress.
My mistress has never met my wife.
George knows David very well.
My mistress's name is Mary.
My wife's name is Mary.
I hate the name Mary. Why couldn't I have been called Samantha?
I've told my wife, Janet, that I'm meeting George tonight. But actually, I'm going to see Mary.
I've told my wife, Mary, that I'm working late tonight. But actually, I'm visiting my mistress.
I'm glad George is working late tonight. David can come and see me.
Now I'm with my mistress, Mary. I wonder if my wife, Janet, believed me.
Now I'm with my lover, David. I wonder if my husband George is working late.
Now I'm with David's wife, Janet. I wonder if Mary and David think they're the only ones having fun.
Well, now, the game's about to begin. The players are lining up. It promises to be a most unusual game, this, because, as you may have heard, both teams have promised, actually sworn, that there will be no foul play, no roughness of any sort. Game's going to be played purely on skill alone, gently, skillfully, no punching, tripping, or kicking the opposing team, pure football. And that is why they've agreed to a lady referee for this match only. She's on the pitch now, looking very attractive in tiny shorts and a low-cut jersey. A fine figure of a woman, this Miss Nora Pinks. Now, she's about to blow a whistle any minute. She takes a deep breath and no one kicked off. They were all watching her take a deep breath. They're finally kicked off now. We now see just how polite they can be to each other. It's a long ball out to Jones. Jones to Huntley, intercepted very delicately by Hall there. Hall right down the field to Blenkinsop, who dribbles daintily around Jerry Taylor, taps it to right. All very polite at the moment. They're all moving very gracefully. And Wright, tripping lightly down the field, loses the ball to Jones, who flicks it to Taylor. And it's Taylor to Jones. Jones back to Wilkes. Tackled by Hall. Put into touch. Throw in by Huntley, out to Wilkes, and Wilkes to Billy O'Shea. Blenkinsop intercepts the ball and taps it lightly out to Wright, and Wright puts the ball across to Hall, but Huntley heads it away, taps it gently across the line for a corner kick. Jones pirouettes, taking the kick, slips in the mud, flat on his back. Huntley comes up and takes the corner. Wright leaps up in the air, misses the ball, and knocks Miss Pinks, who tries to duck and splits her trousers. Blenkinsop tries to head the ball, but Wilkes is right in his way. He boots it under the crossbar, making the score 1-0. Miss Pinks waves her arms, high in the air, down fall her shorts, up goes a cheer. Good gracious, good gracious, it's all over, it's all over, it's all over. Miss Pinks, the referee, has called the game off. She's called it off. Well, that's the first time I've known a game abandoned because of good visibility.
Joe.
Arsenal.
Kippers.
What?
Supper.
Kippers.
Cool.
Arsenal, Chelsea, Bournemouth, Bournemouth. Bournemouth.
Fishing?
Yes.
Holiday?
No.
Oh.
You?
Yes.
London?
Yes. Oh.
Steamer.
Swanage.
Yeah.
Expensive?
Shilling.
Each?
Yeah. Yes?
Yes.
Swanage.
Yes.
Pretty.
Swanage?
You.
Oh.
Lemonade?
Please.
Joe.
Elsie.
Elsie.
Joe.
Hmm?
Thanks. Joe.
Bye.
Bye.
Monday.
Victoria.
Bye.
Bye.
Elsie.
Joe.
Yes.
Supper.
Oh.
Kippers.
Thanks.
There.
Elsie.
What?
Darling.
Daft.
I took my love to Turnpike Lane when Michaelmas was nigh. I thought I'd caught a twinkle in her pretty little eye, but I hadn't. I took my love to Primrose Hill upon St. Swithin's Day, and pointed out the woody woods we passed along the way, but she wouldn't. Potter's Bar when Halloween was near, but though she seemed quite willing, I'd gone off the whole idea, so we didn't.
Ah, Wills, good. Come in. Sit down, will you?
Thanks, Mr. Phibbs.
You got my message?
I just got it.
Good, good. Good. Well, now, have a cigar.
No, thanks. Not for me, Mr. Phibbs.
Well, now, Wills, I hear there's been a little trouble in the factory.
Yes, I suppose you could call it that, Mr. Phibbs.
Well, what in heaven's name is it all about?
Well, I don't exactly know how to put it, Mr. Phibbs.
Now, come on, Wills. I've got to know what it is before I can do anything about it.
Well, Mr. Phibbs, it's simply a matter that the men have... Well, they seem to have taken a turn against some of the products.
Taken a turn?
They just don't seem to like them much anymore.
Don't like them? But we've got the reputation of having the finest machine part turnover in the country. They're the best paid men in the industry. We've got the cheapest canteen in Yorkshire. No two menus are alike, you know. We've got a billiard hall, haven't we? On the premises. We've got a swimming pool, the use of the staff. And what about the long playing record room? And you tell me they're dissatisfied?
Oh, the men are very grateful for all the amenities, sir. They just don't like the products.
But they're beautiful products. I've been in the business a lifetime. I've never seen such beautiful products.
There it is, sir.
Well, which ones don't they like?
Well, there's the brass peacock, for instance.
The brass peacock? What's the matter with the brass petcock?
They just don't seem to like it anymore.
What exactly don't they like about it?
Perhaps it's just the look of it.
Well, that brass petcock, but I tell you, it's perfection. Nothing short of perfection.
They've just gone right off it.
Well, I'm flabbergasted.
It's not only the brass petcock, Mr. Phibbs.
What else?
There's the Emmy Unable spherical rod end.
The Emmy Unable spherical rod end? Where could you find a finer rod end?
They just don't want to have anything more to do with it.
This is shattering. Shattering. What else? Come on, Wills. There's no point in hiding anything from me.
Well, I hate to say it, but they've gone very vicious about the high-speed taper shank spiral flute reamers.
The high-speed taper shank spiral flute reamers? Well, that's absolutely ridiculous. What could they possibly have against the high-speed taper shank spiral flute reamers?
All I can say is they're in a state of very bad agitation about them. And then there's the good metal side outlet relief with hand wheel.
What?
There's the nipple connector and the nipple adapter and the vertical mechanical comparator.
No.
And the one they can't speak about without trembling is the jaw for Jacob's chuck for use on portable drill.
My own Jacob's chuck? Not my very own Jacob's chuck.
They've just taken a turn against the old lot of them, I tell you. Male elbow adapters, tubing nuts, scrub screws, internal fan washers, dog points, half dog points, white metal bushes.
But not, surely not. Not my lovely parallel male stud couplings.
They ain't, and detest your lovely parallel male stud couplings.
Oh.
And the straight flange pump connectors, and back nuts, and front nuts, and the bronze draw-off cock with hand wheel, and the bronze draw-off cock without hand wheel.
Not the bronze draw-off cock with hand wheel.
And without hand wheel.
Without hand wheel.
And with hand wheel.
Not with hand wheel.
And without hand wheel.
Without hand wheel.
With hand wheel and without hand wheel.
With hand wheel and without hand wheel.
With or without.
Tell me, what do they want to make in this place? Trouble.
The case I am about to relate must surely rank as one of the most macabre chapters in the annals of British judicial history, the case of Rex versus Posset. It was January the 28th, 1923, a cold, dark winter morning, as Mrs. Emily Posset, a 54-year-old widow, wound her way through the bleak Suffolk countryside on her newspaper round, a job she had been doing since the death of her husband some 4 years previously. It was 5:30 a.m., and the collar of Isolde's army greatcoat was turned up to give her rough protection against the chill east wind. She had tied string to the tails of the coat to prevent their being caught in the spokes of her bicycle, an innocent and even wise precaution, you might say, but in the end a precaution that was to become totally irrelevant to the amazing court case that was to follow. The bicycle on which she propelled herself at ever-increasing speed had been purchased from a mail-order firm in Colchester in 1919 with the proceeds of her husband's estate, a fact which both the defense and the Crown were later to dismiss as having nothing whatsoever to do with anything at all. We have then a picture of this woman, Emily Posset, 54 years of age, but still taking a pride in her appearance, apparently peddling her way about her lawful business along the narrow lanes of Suffolk. She approaches crossroads. Crossroads she has known since childhood. A farm dray loaded with winter hay crosses her path. She swerves to avoid it. Suddenly...
Oh, blasted.
Suddenly, Emily Posset had a puncture. A simple, unavoidable accident, you might say, but was it? That simple, unavoidable puncture was to deflate not only Mrs. Posset's front tire, but also the reputation of one of the greatest KCs of his generation, Sir Alfred Goss Bradley. Our attention now turns to the driver of the farm dray that had caused Mrs. Posset to tumble headlong from her prized BSA roadster, for such was the make of her bicycle. Our attention turns to one Len Glome. Leonard Francis Glome was a man of some substance. At 18 stone 4, he was one of the finest greasy pig wrestlers in the whole country. More to the point, however, he regarded himself, and here one must not mince words, as something of a ladies' man. He halted the dray with one tug of the reins.
Whoa there!
Clambered to the ground, and taking the acetylene lamp from its clamp at the rear of the dray, he shone its beam through the half light of dawn.
It fell upon the white face of the shaken newspaper delivery woman.
M, you all right?
M, you all right? Note the name he used, M. Not Mrs. Possett, not even Emily, but the diminutive M. The over, even too familiar M. And remember, this was 1923.
M, you all right?
Just about,
she replied with the caustic wit for which he was justly famous in the neighborhood.
I got puncture.
Let me give you an hand.
He did. For more than 20 minutes they toiled together, he removing the wheel, she fetching tire levers from the saddlebag, he finding the hole in her inner tube, she applying the rubber solution. Finally, she took her bicycle pump, and what a gruesome exhibit that bicycle pump was to become. Pumped up the tire and pedaled off into the dawn to finish her paper route. What conversation passed between the two during the operation we shall never know. What we do know is that less than 2 hours later, a passing hedger found Leonard Francis Gloam lying by the side of the lane, his own hands about his throat, his limbs frozen in contorted agony, his lips stretched tight across his teeth in a hideous grin. He was dead. So was his horse. Our attention now turns to Gloam's horse. At 23 hands, it was the finest shire in the county. Local children would wait by the roadside to see him pass, waving their buckets and spades in expectation. Now he lay apparently strangled by his own horse collar in an attempt to disengage himself from the shafts of the farm dray. At first, the local police were completely baffled.
I'm completely baffled,
said a local policeman. So they called in a local vet. At first, he too was mystified.
I'm mystified too,
he said. Then, quite by chance, he noticed a smear of blood on the rear of the animal's left foreleg. Its fetlocks had been punctured. So, too, had Leonard Francis Gloam's. 3 punctures in one morning, 2 of them fatal. Scotland Yard was called in to investigate. The man in charge of investigations, Detective Superintendent Percy Graceless, a man feared by all for his ruthless efficiency. What the local police could not solve in 3 hours of cursory investigation, Graceless solved in less than 2 months of ruthless probing. His relentless pursuit of justice took him from Ipswich to Colchester, Colchester to London, Gallipoli via Manaus, a town half buried in the jungle 2,000 miles up the Amazon. And all the time, as he pieced together the pieces of this gruesome jigsaw puzzle, the evidence pointed inexorably to one person. On April the 17th, 1923, Emily Brenda Possett was arrested and charged with cruelty to a dumb animal, to wit, one horse. And further, that on January the 28th of that same year, she did, with malice aforethought, murder one Leonard Francis Gloam, very nastily, in the county of Suffolk. On June the 17th, she was brought to trial.
How do you plead? Guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty.
The first of many shocks that were to come in this, the most notorious of little-known trials. The defense, as already intimated, was led by one of the great KCs of his time, Sir Alfred Goss Bradley. At 93 and bent double with arthritis, he presented a stark contrast with the dashing, handsome young counsel for the prosecution, Roger Truefitt, an up-and-coming young barrister. The two men outlined their respective cases. The defense claimed she didn't do it, the prosecution that she did. A difference of opinion that must surely lead to conflict. A prosecution witness speaks.
Your name is George Fairlop.
That is correct.
And you are thatcher by trade?
And dying trade, sir, dying trade. I was thinking of taking up conjuring.
Be that as it may, will you tell the court where you were in the early hours of the morning of the 28th of January last year?
I was in the field close by some crossroads in Suffolk.
The same crossroads where the body of Leonard Francis Gloam and his horse were found?
That is correct.
And what were you doing in that field?
I was thinking of taking up conjuring.
Go on.
The man went on to describe what he had seen at the crossroads, a scene I have already described. But the man saw more than just a man and a woman mending a puncture. The operation completed.
She suddenly took something from her puncture outfit, put it in the nozzle with a bicycle pump, pointed it at the man, and with a strangled cry, fell to the ground. The horse turned its head, she reloaded the pump, and then the horse fell as if poleaxed, and she clipped a pump back in her back and rode off, calm as you like.
Do you recognize that woman in this courtroom?
Yes, sir, I do. That woman there, peering over the dock.
Roger Truefitt turned dramatically to the jury, his hands clasped above his head in the manner of triumphant boxers of the time.
How's that?
He cried. The judge asked for clarification.
How's that?
He clarified. And so, this inexperienced young barrister, ably supported with information provided by the dogged investigations of Detective Superintendent Graceless, detailed the case for the prosecution. You will remember that Emily Possett was a widow. Her husband, Albert, had died in the influenza epidemic of 1919. In 1916, however, as a lance corporal in the Suffolk Yeomanry, he served in the Gallipoli campaign under the fire of the Turkish guns. He made friends with an Australian regular soldier, Corporal Stanley Bruce. As a memento of their friendship, the Australian gave Albert Possett a keepsake obtained whilst on a pre-war geographical expedition up the Amazon. Albert Possett brought it back to England with him. It would be very useful for him in his peacetime profession of mole catcher. For that keepsake was none other than a tin of one of the deadliest poisons known to man, curare. After his death, it became the legal property of his widow. She kept it in the saddlebag of her bicycle for, as she was to say later, for a rainy day. Such a so-called rainy day was January the 28th, 1923. It was with tiny steel darts tipped with curare poison that the out-of-work Thatcher had seen Mrs. Possett load her lethal bicycle pump on that fateful morning. It was a convincing story that Roger Truffitt told. The mystery seemed solved, but there was still one piece of the jigsaw puzzle missing. Her motive. Emily Possett took the stand. It was hard going for Truffitt.
But the traces of curare found on the nozzle of the pump.
I used it to shoot moles. In memory of my dear husband. It's what he would have wanted.
And the smears of blood on the wheels of your bicycle.
I deliver the awful gazette to the local slaughterhouse.
Her stonewalling was, of course, to no avail. Even in those early days of forensic science, evidence was evidence, but still no motive. Truffitt tried one last desperate ploy.
We can prove you did it, but please, please tell us why. Please.
It worked.
Well, since you put it like that, how could I refuse? It was just 'cause, I didn't like him, really, between you and me. Nor is the horse.
A mystical answer, maybe. One that is still an enigma to criminologists everywhere. But it was enough. The judge summed up. The jury retired. Sir Alfred Gosbradley shot himself. The jury returned. The foreman delivered the only verdict possible.
Guilty on both charges.
Guilty indeed. Guilty of the most heinous and gruesome crimes set down in the criminal code of all countries that wish to call themselves civilized. The judge pronounced sentence. That Emily Brenda Possett should be hanged by the neck until she be dead. But he had not bargained for Mrs. Possett's native animal cunning. Pretending to faint, she suddenly made a grab for Exhibit A, the poisonous bicycle pump, and sat on it, at the same time shouting,
I've beaten the lot of you!
She died almost instantly, a victim of her own deadly poison dart. Justice had caught up with her, in the end.
The story you have heard was adapted, as far as was possible, from the transcripts of the actual trial. Where this was not possible, we made it up.
Plump, mini-skirted grocer's girl, thy thighs have put me in a whirl. How firm, how tender, how more sweet than all thy rows of luncheon meat. What bliss, instead of bacon drab, if they were lying on the slab, bedecked with parsley all around, marked English, 1 and 8 a pound.
You have been listening to Lines from My Grandfather's Forehead, starring Ronnie Barker, with Terence Brady, Pauline Yates, and Gordon Langford at the piano. The lines were written by Tony Bilbo and Mike Fentiman, Terence Brady, John Graham, Harold Finter, Miles Rudge and Ted Dix, and Gerald Wiley. The program was produced by John Fawcett Wilson.